Hello, I'm Brian.
And I'm Caroline.
I'm Claire.
And this is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm delighted to welcome to the show today Simon Quick, editor of Microscope, which is our channel publication. Hey, Simon.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So how you been? How have you been finding this year of lockdowns and domestic incarceration, serial Zooms?
Yeah, lots of Zooms, lots and lots of Zooms. In some ways, it's been really good. I've been able to go to conferences I would never have been able to go to before, either because of the fact they were too far away or, to be blunt, I wasn't invited. So I've been able to go to loads of conferences, some of which I realised, sadly, after an hour or so, they weren't actually applicable to me. That's been really good. In general, there's been a real concerted effort in the market. Obviously, I write about the channel for communications to increase, and I've benefited from that along with a lot of other people. So it's been easier to talk to people over Zoom and things like that. So yes, there's been moments of Zoom gloom and the repetition of it gets a bit too much. But I think overall, I've been able to do quite a lot more than I would normally have been able to have done. So that's been a positive, I think.
No, that sounds very positive. Yeah. And that mirrors something you're going to say later about the channel about which you're here to talk today.
Yes.
So just to indicate, as usual, where we're going in the episode following Simon's bit on the channel, top line, so Carolina, a different angle on the data center industry. From you today.
Yeah, we've been hearing lots about how, I hate using this phrase, but the data center and cloud industry have had a very good pandemic. And I'm just taking a slightly different look at that, about how that is affecting kind of investor interest in the sector itself, and actually suddenly put the data center industry in the crosshairs of a much wider pool of investors than ever before.
Cool, that's really interesting. More on that later. Claire, you've got a book series for children.
So it's the latest book to come out of Bright Little Labs, which is a children's media company that's run by one of the ladies that frequently appears on our top 50 list of the top 50 women in UK tech.
Yeah, and it does look really cool. I looked through that story earlier. It looks fun. I'm going to talk about the data strategy being developed by Guide Dogs for the Blind. But more on that towards the end of the podcast. We're going to start with Simon. So Claire, can I invite you to get the ball rolling?
You can, but it's not a very specific question, because basically I've never been able to understand exactly what the channel is. And every time I've asked someone, they've tried to explain it and I still haven't been any the wiser, but they always look at me in a way that implies that I should definitely be able to grasp it from what they've said, so I just don't ask any more questions. So what's the channel?
Well, I used to say to people so that they could get it quite quickly, I used to say, imagine a manufacturer, say HP or Dell, and then imagine a customer, so a florist, say, or an estate agent. And the channel I always used to say was the pipe that gets the product from the manufacturer to the customer. I think in a way that's very simple, and it's probably a little bit unfair, because these days some of the channel don't even want to touch the product. But ultimately I'd say, if you think the vast majority of customers, the channel are the people they buy products and services from. I don't blame you for not understanding immediately, because there's so many names, so many acronyms. There's value-added resellers, there's MSPs, managed service providers, there's system integrators, there are people who call themselves consultants, MSSPs, yep, who are managed security service providers. And there are all sorts of different models, but There's single tier, which means manufacturer works directly with a channel, a reseller, or there is the most common is two tier, where somebody like a Cisco has a group of distributors who hold stock, who get marketing funds to develop their campaigns for them and do training, and they serve a base of resellers. But part of the excitement about the channel is it continues to evolve. It never changes. And it's not just a question of acronyms. I mean, those change. But the big one at the moment is that in the communications world, there's a model which is called the master agent model, which is very popular in the States, where you would work with one partner who is your master agent, and then they would work with, say, 10 or 12 others. But you leave them to it. You sort of say, okay, I approve of this relationship and I trust you to deliver it for me. And that's starting to come in here more and more. So it's a really important market because it's how the vast majority, particularly SMEs, it's how they get their technology and how they get their technology support. So I'm thinking about it. I probably haven't helped you at all there. But that's my attempt. That's my attempt to explain it.
I am actually getting flashbacks here to when, because I worked on a channel publication who, for the benefits of, or for the interests of competition, I'm not going to mention by name, because obviously Microscope is, you know, who I champion now. But yeah, I am getting flashbacks to my first interview at that publication when I turned up and I'd kind of like, oh yeah, I know what resellers are. Like, you know, Best Buy, that's it. They resell, say, HP laptops to consumers like me. So I sort of went in there bold and they're like, yeah, Dixon's, Best Buy, PC World, boom, I know what the channel is. And then just as like Simon was explaining there about two-tier retailers, the person who's interviewing me suddenly drew up this huge diagram. Like, hey, here's the end user, here's a reseller, here's a distributor, and right at the bottom is the vendor and all this. And I was like, yeah, I don't know anything. I'm getting like flashbacks to that. But I've always tried to explain it in that, like, say for Computer Weekly, we write about the people who use technology, and the channel is concerned, Microscope is concerned with the people who sell technology, you know, say resellers. How can we make more money off the technology we sell to end users and stuff like that? That's how I try to boil it down. In my first interview, I was just like, okay, so it's PCs. What else, what other technology could people possibly be buying? And then this diagram suddenly expanded into sort of storage, peripherals, servers, software, at the time, sort of cloud licensing products, white box stuff as well. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I really haven't prepared for any of this. And it's, but I mean, once you get your head around it, it's a really, really fun bit of the industry to write about, because it is, you know, it's so much on about relationships and the relationships between other people, between resellers and the distributor partners. And some of the best stories we had would be when there'd be an upset between one or the other. Like, say, if a distributor had changed the terms, they'd offer resellers and they'd all be up in arms and they'd get angry and phone the office. And it was a really great grounding, actually, to become a technology journalist generally, to get that insight into the other side of how things work and everything.
Yes, and I think the other thing is that one of the changes over the last few years has been that people talk an awful lot about ecosystems. And one of the problems, going back to what you were saying there, Caroline, about when I say channel, I think of people like Computer Center, Softcat, CDW, mom and pop resellers. But other people might think BT, SAP, because, like you say, they have an alliance with them to resell. And there's been a lot more bringing that together. And so one of the big things has been, imagine I'm an HPE partner, but then I also sell a little bit of Veeam. Can I get access to Veeam's rewards for that? Because they reward, obviously all these people reward partners for what they do. And so that's where we are right now, in that the channel is again evolving and it's becoming much more around this genuinely broad ecosystem. And people talk about collaboration and cooperation and frenemies, and the idea that the big thing I think that has changed, I've been doing this a fairly long time, and the big thing that has changed is you have people now who genuinely don't want to touch the product. Their role is as an advisor, an influencer, and you never had that, because all the rebate programs and the reward programs are based on what you sold. And so things have shifted, and it's, you know, all about customer experience now and satisfaction and trying to work out, well, what role do you play in this and what's within that ecosystem? So, yeah, I mean, I've been doing it a long time, and I have tried to escape a few times, but then that's another story, didn't work. But in a way, I'm still here because it's fun. Do you know what I mean? It never, years ago, there was a guy who worked in the channel who went from he was very senior. He'd done a lot of things, and he said, I've done a lot of things, and I'm now going to go into the property market as a very senior, you know, big property developers. And I bumped into him at an industry event about 18 months later and said, oh, I didn't expect to see you. He said, it's so boring. He said, every day is the same. And that's the one thing about the channel, it never is. Not only because the technology changes, but the demands from the customer change, the demands from the vendors change, everything changes. So that's why I would say, I can already tell you, I won't be writing about the things I'm writing about now at this time next year, because it will have moved on. The needle moves slightly. And so that's why it's still fun.
Mm. But also you find as well that, like, the people who were quite happy maybe being referred to as like value-added resellers last year, and now, oh, no, we're much more than that. We're I'd say a top-notch solutionization provider.
Okay,
you're a value-added reseller, really. But yeah, that always changes as well. That always used to catch me unawares. But yeah, it was always full, the industry itself is full of sort of big personalities, and you could almost guarantee that if you had, say, in the magazine I work for, if you had a big splash on your front page with like the CEO of, I don't know, say Tech Data or something like that, the following week their competitor, like, PR office would be on the phone, so yeah, he's really unhappy to have seen this, so can we get the same? It's a very, I've never really encountered that before, but it's so sort of, it's all good natured, but it is like there's a lot of level pegging, there's lots of like, I don't like that, okay, we'll get in touch with the press and we'll get our faces on there next.
It's matured a lot. I mean, I think that one of those things which should happen next month, for instance, is that one of Microsoft's largest partners, Bytes, is going to go public. And so if they go public, they join the ranks of people like Softcat. Obviously, Computer Centre have been there a long time. But the interesting thing is, I was talking to, there's an organisation called the Global Technology Distribution Council. And they, in theory, they represent all distributors globally. They do. There's no theory, but I mean, you have to be a member, I guess, to get them to punch more for you. But he was saying to me, the CEO there, that one of the original reasons for setting up that group was to try and flag what distribution did to the investor community. Well, Tech Data has been bought, that was finalized, and that was billions. And so there's now a sense that actually the private equity players, the stock markets, they understand what the channel can do, hence why more channel are going public, and hence why I guess there's more maturity. I always say to people that you could meet a channel director for a large firm, you know, a large vendor, it doesn't matter on size, Oracle, Cisco, whoever, and they'd be lovely people, but they'd be a bit like, let's put this person somewhere where they can't do any harm. And so it used to be a bit of a backwater, and so that has changed now. I meet incredibly ambitious people who view, if you can nail the channel part of the business, which I was talking to HPE's UK channel boss last week, and they're talking about it's 80% of their revenue. So if you can nail the channel business, well, you know, the boardroom may open to you. So you've got a different generation. But yeah, I think that happens. A lot of the owner managers of the old days who didn't mind saying things because, hey, it was their business, and I can say, well, I think that's gone a lot, and shareholders are now there, and realistically, it's a little bit more mature. And I'm going to say, I have to say, I quite like that, because I think what it means is that the professional side of the channel comes much more to the fore.
Mm. Yeah, because there were times where it could be a bit of a free for all, and a bit of a, you're dealing with like sort of, I don't want to do a disservice, but this was 10 years ago that I worked there, so
yeah.
On this, but yeah, like you'd be talking to sort of like proper salesy kind of wide boys about, yeah, I've got like markup on this box of like tin, I'm saying, oh, okay, all right,
yeah.
Like great characters, very kind of entrepreneurial, and
Oh yeah, you don't want that to go, but I think equally, I think the big thing was with the shift to cloud, you couldn't lie. And I remember at the beginning of the whole cloud thing, the big message for the channel from the cloud organizations and stuff was, please don't lie. You've got to be transparent, because if you lie about it and somebody puts their really important data in the cloud, and you've been a bit of a cowboy and sold on price and promise, and it goes wrong, you've got real problems. So I think that was a big moment, probably, where those people who had blagged it a bit felt, actually, we've got to either we do it for real or we go, you know?
Mm. Yeah, because there is so much trust put in to sort of, you know, entrusting your data, even if it's just a psychological thing, from putting, okay, we're putting it in a cloud, compared to, oh, we're putting it on a server, which we know where it is and everything. Yeah, so it all sort of plays into that quite a bit as well.
Yeah. The thing I wanted to share with you guys and the listeners was just that the channel, and like you were saying, you don't want to talk about this year in the sense of good, but I think for the channel, and it's not universal, there's, you know, those resellers who focus on hospitality and leisure and travel have had it really tough. But I think overall, if you think the biggest ambition for a channel partner is to become the trusted advisor of the customer, and this year has been that moment where you prove that. We're ending the year, I think, with a lot of people thinking, I've shown my value, and I've talked about value for a long time, value-added reseller, you know, it's in the title, but this year has been the year most people have done it. And as a result, if you ask most people in the channel what they feel about 2021, it's real optimism, because two things really. One, digital transformation. So the customers can't turn off the tap. They've got to keep spending. SMEs in particular have to keep reaching out to the channel partner. But equally, the channel partner is now somebody seen as much more integral to that process. I mean, the thing, some people use the word quite a lot during the first lockdown, but some of the things that the channel did, and I don't mean this in a cliched way, they were genuinely heroic in terms of people giving their time. There was Logicalis, they went into a Spanish hospital and spent 36 hours just giving their time to get their data center back up after a crash. You've had people like SCC helping set up and expand the NHS PPE training website. And a lot of these efforts have been done for free or just to help out. And it's been interesting. One of the biggest problems in the channel has been stock. But the stories I've heard is that if you had somebody on the phone moaning about, where's the stock? I've got this customer desperate for laptops to get people working from home. If the distributor said, I'm afraid we had some in, but it went to the NHS, that was fine. People didn't complain. They went with it. So it's been a sobering time. And for somebody like me, who's been doing the channel for a long time, I have to say it's been a moment where you feel actually a bit of pride that what you're involved with is decent and has done quite a lot of good. So, yeah, a lot of optimism about next year.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because, like, on my side of things, from the data center perspective, is when we're talking to people at the minute, and then we're getting quite a lot of case studies at the minute about people who've had to rapidly scale up their data center operations, or, you know, buy more data center kit, and the supply shortages have happened because of COVID. And almost invariably, everyone is like, we wouldn't have been able to deliver on this project if, you know, our partner who supplies that hadn't been able to sort of grease the wheels somehow, get us the kit, work around the supply chain challenges of either sort of countries being in lockdown, not being able to get product through the usual supply routes and stuff like that, and people pulling out all the stops to make sure, you know, change can still happen. And it's funny actually just seeing the crossover from obviously what you write about and how that feeds into further along the sort of end user story, really.
So that kind of traditional strength of the channel to do with kind of personal relationships really is kind of intensifying through the pandemic. Would you say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's been absolutely key, I think, you know, because it becomes a lot about trust, and there's not been really a single customer unaffected by it. So I think across the board, people have had to reach out, and for the most part, from what I hear, the channel has been there for them. So I think that's been, yeah, really important.
And so is the opposite of the channel direct sales?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, it is. The opposite of the channel is you sell direct, but there are serious problems with that. I mean, there's a model which is, imagine you set up a company next week, Brian. I wouldn't expect you to build a channel because you don't have potentially the people to support that. You might not have the money to give the marketing funds or the campaign. So at that point, yeah, you'd sell direct. You might do that for a year or so, building the brand. But at some point, if you want to get the geographical spread, you have to go channel. The biggest example of people who did sell direct was Dell. And they did it for a long time. But about 10 years ago, Dell came back to the channel. And Dell now gets, I think last count was something like $52 billion a year from the channel. That's its channel revenues, which is significantly higher than quite a lot of other companies in their own right. So that's been brilliant because it has taken that direct, indirect, that whole argument, and Dell coming back and really doing well with the channel has almost said there is no argument anymore. There are moments you might want to be direct and the channel will understand you doing that, but you've got to be very, you can't be both. That's the other big thing. Yes, you can have your top customers, your HSBCs, Bank of Americas, they like to buy direct. And you've got to be transparent. So some vendors will have lists and say, these are our direct customers and we're showing them to you so you understand that. But you can't, where there's problems is channel conflict, is where people compete. But I think most people have got the message now, which is, for instance, if you wanted to sell, if you're based in London, but you wanted to sell across the Southwest, how are you going to do that? You can have a rep who's in a car driving around all day and he or she can do what they can do, which could be great. But imagine if you had 10, 15 resellers covering that region, all with numerous relationships. It's no brainer. I've never really understood. It's a bit like, you know, the Jedi versus Vader's crowd. Never really got it, you know. It may be attractive at some points, but you've got to go the right way, and the right way is indirect and channel.
Because there have been instances, I know when I was a channel journalist, where it actually causes quite a lot of mistrust, doesn't it? Companies that kind of flip between the two because they don't know at what point, like, will this company decide to take a deal direct and, you know, cut out their resellers from it and stuff like that. And it makes people wary of continuing to be a partner of that company and things like that. I know that was quite a few of the stories we used to cover, or a rich vein of stories we used to cover.
I think you can tell because it's cultural. So to give you an example, Sophos, the security people, they're 100% channel. Everybody in that organization knows we're 100% channel. Whereas if you go to another vendor that maybe is, like you said, trying to straddle both sides, internally, you've got people who are saying, well, hold on, how am I measured? So Sophos would say to their internal sales team, you're measured by generating a opportunity, which is then converted by a partner. That's clear. But imagine if I was sitting there and I thought, I've got a target to hit. And if I sold this, I'd hit my target. I might upset a partner, but I, you know, culturally, I've got a sales team that's a bit vague about it. So I think it's cultural. And I think the channel often can tell who's really genuine about it, you know.
So that Billy McInnes feature linked to from the article that accompanies the podcast, on the whole, because he spoke to a lot of people, a real range of folk.
Yeah.
Is the overall thing to be cautiously optimistic for 2021?
Yeah, cautiously optimistic. I think a lot of people I speak to, speaking to somebody yesterday, said that the second lockdown really hurt November. People were expecting, I think his phrase was, a short, sharp December, which would be very positive. And I think there's been an awful lot of optimism around the vaccine. Hope that will come sort of maybe Q2 next year. And as a result, the market will continue to bounce back. But I think if you talk to most people about what's driving the market, it's things like the umbrella term of digital transformation, but there's things like 5G, there's, you know, still things like data analytics, a massive, massive demand for cybersecurity. So most of the people in the channel look at the actual factors which customers are juggling and say, well, look, whatever happens, there's got to be some growth here, because going forward, you know, these things remain top priorities, certainly security. So, yeah, cautious optimism, but I think, fingers crossed, most people I speak to say April was the worst, and that was, people hope that would be the trough, and then we start to get back. But it feels very, very different from things like 2008, where it just felt like the wind had gone out of the industry sails.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because, and also the Millennium Bug. Millennium Bug, it felt, and I'm revealing now, I've been around quite a long time, but Millennium Bug, it felt like this is all our fault. We've created this situation. We've overstated the need for a refresh, and now we've got a long time. Back then, of course, people were sticking to this 3 or 4 year PC refresh, and it, so everybody was like, right, here we go, we're in for a rough time. 2008, it just hit customers really hard, so the spending stopped. This time, it feels as if tech, and again, I don't like using the phrase good because it hasn't been good, thousands have died, but people say to me, tech is a good place to be. It's shown its value, its resilience, and I think a lot of the channel are voicing that publicly and certainly privately, is saying, look, if anything, at least we're in the tech world. And so, yeah, out of the three big economic impacts I would have worked through, certainly this one, it feels like we might be slightly more immune than some of the others, because the need for technology, and a lot of people are talking about technology being part of the route to recovery. So I think there's a sense that, yeah, you can be cautiously optimistic, hopefully.
And it sounds like also the pandemic period has also kind of changed and maybe accelerated some of those maturing trends and tendencies that you were talking about. So it's actually kind of changed slightly the nature of the beast.
At the moment, the big one is that the jury's out a little bit about what will be temporary, what will be permanent. But from a channel point of view, one of the huge changes was the dramatic increase in communication. And I think that's going to be quite hard to scale that back, because I think people have enjoyed it. People have found it very, very useful, particularly the events. I was at an MSP conference a couple of weeks ago, and they had a chat bar running live where we were encouraged to speak to each other. And one of the comments was that somebody was saying, I have two young children. I've never been able to come physically to this event. Please, please keep it virtual, an element of it virtual going forward. So I think that's going to be a real challenge for the channel, to say, okay, there's been a lot of good that's come out of it. Let's try and keep the good and not just snap back into this idea that, look, unless you're at the partner event in Vegas, you're not going to find out anything. And I think that's going to be a challenge, because there's a monetary aspect to it. Some of the vendors, it is a big money earner. But I do think that there's been a lot of good that's come out in terms of certainly communication and sharing a best practice. There's been more people in the channel talk about caring for each other, particularly seminars and workshops about mental health, than there's ever been before. And I think that needs to stay. Fingers crossed, people will look at it and say, if we can make the time. My hope is that if you care about each other now, please don't stop caring about each other when we're back to like Q3 next year and it's all guns blazing, the big conferences are coming up and the product launches and everyone's saying, we've got to smash the targets in Q4. My hope is that the increased humanity that we've seen will remain. That's my hope.
That's a brilliant thought. The data center industry has also been kind of booming in a way, but also maybe changing too, and also been seen in a somewhat different light by the investor community. Caroline, I know you've written a big feature about that.
Yeah, and it does follow on from a lot of the trends that Simon's touched upon during his interesting bit of the discussion there. And it's, yeah, it's around the fact that there's no getting away from the fact that because of the pandemic, all of us in our work and leisure time are using online services and cloud services much more than we ever have before for the interests of collaboration, communication. And all of those services obviously need data centers to make them work. And over the course of 2020, we've heard numerous anecdotal reports from IT leaders talking about how the pandemic has prompted them to accelerate the pace of their digital transformations, almost to the point of cliche now that, you know, given how frequently I seem to be quoting people at the moment who are like, oh, our cloud migration plans, you know, things that we planned in to take 5 years, we've managed to deliver in 5 weeks or 5 months. It's just the same quote over and over again. It's almost as I'm writing them, I'm like, oh, I'm going to predict before he actually says this. Will it be 3 months? Will it be 5 months? Oh, nailed it. So one of the main beneficiaries of this trend is the co-location data center community, who've been building a very healthy business over the last decade or more by renting out data center space to the big tech firms. So the hyperscalers, as we call them, the Amazons, Microsofts, Google, Facebook, all of those people. And what the pandemic has done effectively is sort of poured rocket fuel on that trend. And the demand for co-location data center space is absolutely soaring in all of the major data center hubs at the minute, because, like I say, we're all spending a lot more time online. At the same time, the amount of money being spent on mergers and acquisitions within the co-location space has hit a record high this year, to the point that 4 months into 2020, more money had been spent on data center M&As than during the whole of last year. So as part of my coverage of the data center beat for Computer Weekly, I have semi-regular phone catch-ups with contacts about things that are going on. Sometimes it leads to stories, sometimes it's just a bit of, oh, that's an interesting bit of gossip, and you sort of file it away, hoping that, you know, that will come in useful for a feature or something later down the line. But a recurring theme of the discussions I've been having recently has been about the fact that the pace at which the co-location market is growing hasn't gone unnoticed by the investor community, but the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic seems to have been attracting a much broader pool of investors to the market than ever before. So on that point, so it's probably worth explaining that investors and things like that isn't really an area that we do a lot of writing about on Computer Weekly, aside from maybe the odd kind of financial results story here and there. And we might sort of go, oh, on the back of this, you know, the share price has tanked or gone up. And also, it's also worth mentioning as well, it's not exactly news that investors are interested in data centers, because building a data center is very, very expensive. And any sort of new market entrant or co-location provider looking to sort of rapidly expand their presence is probably going to need some outside investment from somewhere, unless they're sitting on really, really big cash reserves. But what is different now is, like, typically the sorts of investors have been sort of real estate companies, sort of because of the amount of land that needs to be bought for data centers, or they've been energy companies because of the amount of power that data centers consume. So it's kind of, oh, well, if we invest in data centers, we're going to benefit off this, because the more data centers that are built, the more money that changes hands in terms of power, or also the more land they'll buy. So that will benefit us as well. But what's happening now is the industry itself is starting to attract investors from other areas, which hasn't really happened before. And it's quite interesting for an industry that is so famed for its secrecy that it is coming to the attention of other people. So, and a lot of this, again, is on the back of COVID. We're starting to see investors who may have previously sort of made a killing in bricks and mortar retail or aviation or hospitality, because of the, you know, basically COVID has decimated those industries, they're looking for new places to get a return on their investment now. And like I say, the growth in co-location demand and stuff like that makes them think, oh, okay, this looks like a good market. And I've been talking to some of my contacts and they're sort of saying, oh, we're starting to see people like pension funds investing in data centers. And that is because they sort of see it as quite a good long-term bet for an investment, because when people rent co-location space, they usually do on really lengthy lease terms, so maybe 15, 20 years. So it's kind of, well, if you put your money in it, the amount of data center space they typically take up only grows. They usually, this phrase, land and expand. They don't tend to go, oh, we'll take up a little bit and then we'll scale it back year on year, because, you know, we want to get out of data centers. They always take on more. So it's seen as quite a safe bet from that perspective. And yeah, I guess the other thing as well is that historically, during really bad economic times that we are basically in the midst of at the minute, the amount of money spent on co-location goes up because people are always looking to outsource IT and things like that. So again, like I say, you can see all the reasons why this is being seen as a good, as they would say, alternative asset class for investors. But the thing with this sort of feature I've been writing about as well is, like, kind of looking at all of that, but also looking at the pitfalls. You know, for the uninitiated, you know, data centers look like a really sure bet and like something everyone should be rushing into and spending money on. But it's also an area where, you know, it's easy to fall into the trap of maybe being a bit too overconfident in the area itself. So one thing we've heard about is, let's say, colocation companies who are seeing all this money sloshing around on mergers and acquisitions, thinking, oh, okay, well, we've got some colocation facilities, you know, we could probably make a killing, let's put ourselves up for sale and like get in on all this. But not all colocation companies are created equal, and there might be a lot of reasons why they're just not, they don't sell. You know, it might be because they don't have any sort of good anchor tenants. You know, at the moment, a good anchor tenant would be someone like Amazon, Google, like a big company, you know, who you know aren't going to go out of business anytime soon. If they're taking up a lot of, if they're renting a lot of space off you, think, okay, that looks like a safe bet for the future. We've written loads of stuff in the past on Computer Weekly about, and I actually might be responsible for hyping up some of the sales prices going on, actually, thinking about this. But we write stories about like mega data center builds that are being built. And you think, oh my God, that's so exciting. They're going to build like a data center. It's going to be huge. It's going to be here. It's going to be in a far-flung bit of the country. That sounds quite interesting. You don't get a lot of that going on there. And what happens is they build the data center, and unlike Field of Dreams, nobody comes because it's in the wrong location. It's not near a major city. It's, you know, network connectivity is not good enough for like a big company to want to entrust their data in there. And it all kind of falls apart. So there's kind of a danger at the minute that people might just think, oh, data centers, I'll throw my money at everything. And then, you know, they'll end up coming unstuck. So that's sort of something that this sort of article is looking at as well, is just kind of looking at, okay, there's a lot more money coming in and you can see why, but there's also reasons why people need to be cautious about what they're investing in. The article came together after having all these conversations with people. And it was just interesting to me that you could actually, as you're having these conversations, what you can actually do is almost kind of track the sort of ripple effect of, say, a CIO somewhere in a boardroom saying, right, okay, we need to do more in cloud, and then track that all the way through the supply chain to sort of like, okay, so what's the knock-on impact to that? Okay, they'll buy more services off, say, AWS or Google or something like that. Further along, Google and AWS, if lots of people have this same idea, they're going to need more co-location capacity from somewhere. And then you follow that along to, okay, so the co-location companies are going to make more money. What are they going to do with that money? You know, they'll probably buy more space. So who's that going to attract the attention of? Investors. And then just seeing how that all plays out across the market and stuff like that. So it's just, I just thought, oh, this could be a slightly different take on the impacts of digital transformation for Computer Weekly. And it might just be a sign I've got too much time on my hands, so I sit there and think about this stuff. That is the article, and hopefully it's in workflow at the moment, so hopefully it'll be published over the next week or so.
So I really enjoyed Caroline's feature. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. The connections that she makes between corporate IT and just the elements of the data center industry and the investor community, and also you know, people who play the stock market and are looking at the these companies like Equinix, CyrusOne, Digital Realty, looking at those as stocks to invest in. Just all the way that the piece ties all those things together is just really interesting. It's a really, really good read. It's a really good piece. And I'm also struck with the kind of the parallel in a way with the channel, because like with the channel, IT has to get sold somehow. And similarly with, there's this phrase in Caroline's piece about a server farm somewhere. Even Amazon stuff, Google stuff, Microsoft stuff has to go somewhere, unless they're building their own data centers, which I think they're also doing as well, aren't they? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was like one of the things that they could come unstuck, investors later down the line, that at the moment, all the big tech firms are renting data center space, but they're also at the same time investing their own money in getting experts in-house about how to do all this stuff themselves. So there is a concern going forward that they might sort of start reducing their reliance on co-location and building their own facilities. But yeah, the jury's sort of out of like how big a threat that is at the minute. But no, there's definite parallels between the channel and co-location. Yeah, that whole market was, ever since I've been covering data centers, has always been like, this is probably the closest bit out of anything from moving from being a channel journalist to a general tech journalist, if you like. This is the closest thing I've ever come to something that is basically channel like. It is the partnerships between, you know, the vendors and the co-location community is very similar to, say, a vendor reseller sort of dynamic and things like that. And also just being, I guess, at the mercy of what like the vendors might do next if they decide, oh, we are going to go, no, we don't want the channel anymore, we're going to go direct. If like, this is a similar trend, if a hyperscale company says, oh, we're going to build our own data centers and we're going to bypass co-location, it's the same sort of conflict that Simon was talking about earlier.
It's a very good read. It really, really is. And another good read Claire's going to talk about is, well, tell us all about it, Claire.
Yes. So this happened a couple of weeks ago now, but Bright Little Labs, which, as I mentioned earlier, is a children's media company, released a new book called Agent Asher, Mission Shark Bites. Wow. Say that a few times fast.
The Sean Connery is there.
So this is the second book to come out of Bright Little Labs. The original book that they released was called Detective Dot. And the premise was the same. Basically, the protagonists of these books are aimed at being role models for children to get them more interested in science, technology, engineering, and maths. And the point of these books is that they match up with the computing curriculum. So it's sort of meant to be a fun way to teach computing to kids, and also in sort of like an offline way so that they might be more accessible. So the books come with a pack of fun things to do as well. And children who receive the materials are inducted into the Children's Spy Agency, which is a secret group which provides children with materials online and offline to help them, you know, like think critically and do some of those other skills that are in the school curriculum, but learning things like coding and internet safety, how to spot fake news, and stuff like that. That's basically what the book is. And the CEO of Bright Little Labs, Sophie Dean, who is one of the women that features on our top 50 list of the most influential women in UK tech, she's been in that list for a few years in a row now, and she basically said, you know, there isn't a lot of representation in children's media, and it's good to just, you know, like get children engaged in different ways, basically in the technology space. It's coding and other skills like that are really sought after by employers. They're something that we are trying to teach kids, so it's like an accessible way for children to get involved in STEM, basically.
Yeah, and the Children's Spy Agency sounds really cool. CSA.
Yeah, so I was at a little while ago, I went to a brainstorming meeting with Sophie and a couple of other, you know, like tech people, education people, to sort of talk about how the CSA can be used to as a platform to engage kids. And we came up with loads of like really cool ideas. We were like, what if they could like sticker bomb places, you know, you send them a pack of stickers and they stick them around in like secret, oh, I'm part of the CSA, you should be too, type thing. Obviously that's, you know, I don't know if they've actually ended up doing that because it's graffiti, I suppose. But yeah, it was really fun to be sort of like brainstorming, trying to think outside of the box, because once you become an adult, you sort of don't get a lot of chances to do that. You know, like if I were a kid, what would I have liked? How would I have liked to engage with something like that? How would I want to learn? You know, like how can we make it a secret that they feel like the adults aren't involved in, and it's just something for them, and they're being, you know, sneaky spies type thing. So that was quite fun.
Yeah, it's quite a good way of getting kids engaged in this stuff as well, without, because it's just very hard. So, hey kids, you should consider a career in tech. Yeah, yeah, right, thanks. So it's like a way of highlighting career paths, opportunities, and just like get them to think about what else is out there, really.
Yeah, exactly. And the main character, Asher, she's, you know, like just a normal kid like them, but then she engages in these secret missions with her friend who's a drone. And I think she has a selfie stick that can emit farts as well if she gets in a spot of bother. So, you know.
Very useful to have. I can think of at least three use cases in my own personal life where I could do with one of those.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, you know, it's quite a fun way to approach it.
It could be Christmas present territory.
Could be, yeah.
Kind of reminds me that there's a thing called a Custom Eyes book program for visually impaired children, kind of similar theme in a way. And that's one of the things that Guide Dogs for the Blind, Guide Dogs, does. They do a lot of stuff, Guide Dogs, that are not just about the dogs, about other things as well. And that's one of the things that they do is that customized program or product. So I mention this because couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with the CIO of Guide Dogs about his data strategy, alongside Caroline Carruthers, who's a kind of strategy consultant around data. She and Peter Jackson have got a company. They run a summer school for chief data officers and things like that. She was chief data officer at Network Rail, among other things. So I've interviewed her a few times, but so I interviewed them together, Jared and Caroline. And yeah, so Guide Dogs, he's CIO. So that encompasses the kind of data piece. He jokes that anything that's to do with data or has a plug is his responsibility because he's CIO. And he's been there for about a year and a half or something now, but he wants to have a data strategy. So why does he want to do that? Like a lot of organizations, really, they have kind of pockets of data management and analysis around the organization that's been very organic. We're like a small group, maybe a couple of marketing people or whatever will be doing stuff with data. So multiple data teams, and they have a legacy system. Can you believe that? Like everyone else has a legacy system. So yeah, so they want to develop this data strategy essentially because he didn't have one before. Now, it's a charity, and like any charity, the data strategy is to do with getting more money in. So he's worked in a few places, including the Great Ormond Street charity that, you know, supports the hospital. His thing would be kind of getting more money, getting from donors for the hospital and so on. So there's the same thing with Guide Dogs, getting more money from donors and, you know, trying to use data to predict who would have a propensity to give more money and so on. But they also have the dogs. So there's the dog side of data management with them as well, which introduces this kind of interest and twist. They are the largest breeder of guide dogs in the world. So they have about 2,500 dogs who are out with their human partners, with their owners. And they want to more or less double that by 2023. So that's quite a big ambitious goal to do that. In terms of data and the dogs, and they're not there yet, but the idea is to do data analysis on like the genomics of the dogs. And the key thing is to try and predict what puppies are going to make it to be, are going to make the grade to be guide dogs, because lots of the dogs don't make it and they fall out of the program, and then they get, you know, they go and become part of families and stuff. So they become like not working guide dogs.
So they don't end up on the streets.
No.
Into drugs.
Or disappear off to the farm. We all know where the farm is.
Don't just get discounted. but if they can identify what the kind of genetic characteristics are of the dogs that make it and become great guide dogs. And he it was a bit of a joke really, but he said if it's a question of a large tongue equals great guide dog, then they would have a biomarker that would help them to, you know, stop over investing in these dogs that are simply not going to make it. Now they're not there yet because they haven't done all that data work, and they need to get all the data together in order to do that. He described it as you know, getting hard data about soft data points, and they have this what he describes a dog behavior monitoring tool that like the puppy walkers and so on use. And it was not entirely clear to me to what extent that was like a way of talking about a framework, because some of that's about software, some of it's not, which is quite an interesting problem from a knowledge management point of view, because a lot of the knowledge that their, you know, their workers and their volunteers have about the dogs is in their heads. So what they want to do is get that knowledge out of their heads a bit more and into software systems. So for instance, from January, they've got an app that Salesforce has helped them to develop that will enable people to input information kind of digitally. I mentioned Salesforce. They have a Salesforce database, which is where all their dog data resides. They plan to have a bigger Salesforce database that will encompass the people that they deal with, whether it's their employees or their volunteers or their donors, et cetera, et cetera. It's very early days, I have to say, with this data strategy, and I'm sure Jared wouldn't mind me saying that. So there is tech in this. I'm not going to say very much about it. There's a Salesforce database. They're planning to have a data warehouse. They haven't decided what platform they're going to go for.
Data warehouse, they completely missed the trick. They could just call it the doghouse, really.
I've got a feeling they might do that.
Yes.
Thinking similar. They have that kind of culture, it seems to me. They'll probably go Azure, but they might not. They haven't decided what kind of cloud platform they're going to use. He did say, Jared, which I thought was an interesting comment, that Microsoft, they're a big Microsoft customer and they use Power BI, et cetera. But he said that Microsoft does a lot for the third sector. They don't kind of make a big deal of it. They just do a lot of good stuff for the third sector. So shout out to Microsoft. He's there from Guide Dogs. But I thought it was an interesting comment. It's quite good when you get to talk to someone who is, after all, a CIO, so he's deeply, deeply immersed in this stuff in the way that we're not. What else to say about it? Caroline Carruthers was very keen to stress that what they're doing at the moment is getting the basics right. So they are looking at kind of AI to do the kind of genomics data, which is also, she said, very interesting. They have a chatbot on their website. Use blind people or visually impaired people. Alexa is very popular with them. So like the guide dog handbook is available to them through Alexa and things like that. But Caroline was stressing that at the moment they're just trying to get the absolute basics right. And Jared had this very, I thought, very interesting phrase that they want to go from a singular view of data to an organizational view. So to get from that little pockets of data work that's very siloed to data being part of the kind of brain of the organization, if you like. Getting a bit carried away with a metaphor there. So that's all that. The dogs themselves, they're mostly Labradors. I didn't get to the, I've still not got an answer on the brown Labrador question.
As someone who has a brown Labrador at home who is pretty much insane and most uncalm, and you would just not want to entrust him with help guiding anyone across a road or anything like that. It just made me think, that's probably a reason you never see any brown Labradors as guide dogs traditionally.
But that's really interesting you say about the behavior there, though, because he said that it's very hard to untrain the dogs in terms of chasing things, because they like to chase things. They especially like to chase cats. And if you've got a guide dog and, you know, you're walking down the street and then he or she sees a cat and starts chasing it, it's not a good result.
Yeah. No, I think when you talked about this story previously, I mentioned there's a program on Netflix called Pick of the Litter, where they follow a litter of Labrador puppies along as they are sort of going through the selection process for, I guess, the US equivalent of guide dogs. And yeah, it's really interesting watching that. It's the ones who just manage to take the commands and like not get any sort of stimulus at all. But then every so often, it's just because of the instinct. One of them will go rogue and they're like, right, you're off the program. Sorry, mate, you're being retired. You're going off to live with like a naval family in America and live out the rest of your days because you're not fit for this line of business, son. Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, how they train that out of them. But in regards to the brown Labrador question, I did some research on that myself. And apparently it's because they were always bred to be play dogs, whereas the yellow and black Labradors were always trained to be sort of working dogs and be a bit calmer in temperament, whereas the brown ones were just always supposed to be like toy dogs and, you know, entertain children.
It is mostly Labradors that they have a few Labradoodles and some German Shepherd dogs, which were the original guide dogs. When it was founded in 1934, it was German Shepherd dogs were the kind of pioneer hounds for this type of work. Almost finished writing up that case study. I know Jared and Caroline are both asking me where the case study is. And as usual, we'll provide a link to that and to all the stories that we've discussed today in the article that goes along with the podcast on computerweekly.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Amazon Music. So you can ask Alexa for us. Sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. So may I say thank you very much indeed to our special guest, Simon Quick.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And as everyone always, it remains for me to say thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much to Claire.
Anytime.
And thank you very much to you, listener, for listening. Stay safe and bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.